The ICJ opinion went on to say things that I found particularly wonderful, because in my analysis of the situation with many other people in the occupied territories, we've been saying this for years, and the Israeli Supreme Court has always been saying, no, 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 you're wrong. It was very nice to have a very, very high court in the world saying that we were right. It affirmed that Israel was and still is the occupying power. All the Oslo Accords in the world cannot stop Israel from being the occupying power, because Israel has the power, and it's there on the ground, in fact, with a right to go anywhere it wants at any time, its own right, not international law right. The ICJ also opined that East Jerusalem is part of the occupied territories, despite the fact that Israel has annexed it. They reaffirmed that you can't acquire territory by force, that the Fourth Geneva Convention and the Hague regulations, those are the laws of war, do apply to the occupied territories. They also said that international human rights law applies to the occupied territories, which is great news for those of us who've been arguing this for a while. Specifically, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the Covenant on the Rights of the Child. Those are three treaties that the ICJ mentioned specifically, but all human rights law, international human rights law, does apply. And so you can look at all the treaties that Israel has signed and hold them accountable, to try to hold them accountable to those treaties, as long as it says this applies to Israel's jurisdiction, not to its national territory. The ICJ also said that settlements and settlers are illegal, including in East Jerusalem. It called for a two-state solution, as I mentioned, based on Articles Security Council Resolutions 242 and 338, and stated that any negotiated settlement that Palestinians make with Israel cannot ignore these international laws. It called on both sides to end violence against civilians. There's no internationally recognized one definition of terrorism, by the way, but most people can get the gist that it's violence against civilians, which is terrorism. And unfortunately, the ICJ made no mention of refugees or 194, Resolution 194, which calls for the return of refugees. I think they decided very carefully just to not deal with that. Although I think that one can deal with it if one wants to. There was a dissent to the opinion. The U.S. judge, Thomas Bergenthal, dissented to some of the things, but he didn't dissent to the fact that ICJ had jurisdiction. He didn't dissent to the fact that all of that area is occupied territory and that Israel must abide by the Fourth Geneva Conventions and that settlements are illegal. He just didn't feel that the court had the requisite factual basis for all of its findings. One other judge dissented on the fact that everyone should enforce the Fourth Geneva Convention. But for the most part, this was a close to unanimous decision in most regards, and a unanimous decision in other regards. Israel's response was that they would not recognize this advisory opinion and that they will continue building the security fence, which is their term for the wall, and they have. The U.S. made it clear that it will veto any Security Council action or resolution about this, and the U.S. House of Representatives voted 361-45 to condemn the misuse of the International Court of Justice. And a similar thing is going through in the Senate, spearheaded by Washington State's own Senator Patty Murray. Britain opposes the wall, but also opposed ICJ jurisdiction, and the UN General Assembly voted very shortly after this decision, by 150-6, to accept the ICJ opinion, to ask for reconvening the signatories of the Fourth Geneva Convention to consider the opinion and consider what to do in light of it. And they asked the UN to begin to compile a register of property destroyed by the wall. Canada was among the 10 abstentions, as you noted in your original invitation to people to come to this talk. But it was 150-6. Against in the UN General Assembly. The US and Israel were the major votes against it. Here are some ideas on the implications of this decision. Advisory opinions are, as I said, non-binding, but they can be used and acted upon by the UN, and they carry great moral force, especially when affirmed by the UN General Assembly, as this was so quickly. Indirectly, this led to sanctions being placed on South Africa. There was an ICJ opinion about that, and it led to independence for Namibia, among other things that it has done. It led eventually to the Never mind. It's a different case in which actually the ICJ ruled that the U.S. was breaking law by mining Nicaragua's harbors, and the U.S. said, well, we're going to ignore your opinion, but eventually they stopped anyway. So the ICJ has moral force sometimes in its rulings as well as in its advisory opinions. Nations can legitimately pressure each other to meet international law obligations under the UN Charter. And of course, Canada is a member of the UN and bound by its charter. And since this is an issue that has been characterized by everyone as a threat to peace and security in the world, and because Israel has ignored so many resolutions already enacted by the UN, it makes sense to go to the next level. The UN should be called on to do more. The UN Charter has various ways that you can settle international disputes by peaceful means. I guess we can't go and bomb them. And ask that countries refrain from force. I'm not advocating that. The United States, however, has a bit of a history of trying to solve resolutions by bombing them. I don't agree with it. So the UN Charter recommends negotiation, mediation, binding arbitration, the ICJ to actually take a court case. The Security Council can also try to settle the dispute. It can order countries to court. It can sever diplomatic relations. Any country can do this too. Boycotts, forming international tribunals to try people, laying down sanctions, sending UN forces in to arrest some of the people responsible, or order military armed force. These are things that the Security Council can do. And nations can also use, quote, other peaceful means of their own choice. And again, all nations, no matter whether they have signed any treaty or not, are bound by this, by the responsibility to help ensure people's self-determination. So Canada should call on all countries to help it in whatever campaign you decide to launch, regardless of what treaties they've signed. Certainly, calling for an end to aid to Israel or an end to selling certain kinds of military or other hardware used in the wall, Caterpillar bulldozers perhaps, would stem naturally from this decision. Since part of the advisory opinion mentioned the rights, the Treaty on the Rights of the Child, you might try to involve children's groups, children's rights groups to help this, your campaign. Other possibilities include, non-renewal of trade privileges or agreements, divestment. Some of that has started to happen in the United States. You could certainly show the way for us to broaden divestment beyond schools and charities like churches. It's very hard to get city councils and government bodies to divest. If you could shine the light for us, that would be really helpful. Boycotts, sanctions, restrictions on Israeli exports. You could freeze assets. You could extradite, I like these, you could extradite or prosecute criminals. You could issue international arrest warrants. You could try someone in absentia in a people's tribunal here. Don't wait for your government to do it. You could take a case to the International Criminal Court, who has jurisdiction over any individual accused of committing crimes against humanity or war crimes or genocide committed after July 1st, 2002. That's anybody who's been involved in the wall. Could be taken to the ICC. Ariel Sharon is the person I would suggest. Now I'm just going to go very quickly, my last little part here, to talk about some actions and campaigns that have been occurring around the world against the wall, sort of to try to spark your inspiration. I think we saw on the multimedia presentation there a few of the things that are going on in Palestine, but if you came in right before that got turned off, you might not have seen that. There are a lot of grassroots village campaigns going on in Palestine against the wall. Palestinians are leading the way in nonviolent resistance to the occupation. I should stress that. We tend to hear in American media and perhaps somewhat in Canadian media, we tend to hear about the violence. But that's 5% of what's going on over there. Most of the violence is coming from the Israeli army. You just need to look at the horrendous, not only death statistics, but also at the injury statistics to see that most of the violence is coming from the Israeli army, and most of the resistance is nonviolent for the Palestinians. Yes, there is also violent resistance. I should mention that a lot of Israelis are helping with the Palestinian nonviolent resistance. Many Israelis and groups, Israeli groups, are getting involved in resisting and being arrested along with everybody else for resisting. And of course, the international solidarity movement can stand with Palestinians doing nonviolent resistance, add a little bit of their non-Palestinian privilege to a demonstration. Rachel Corey showed that nobody is immune from getting killed over there, but internationals are still treated better than Palestinians there. Budrus is a town that's, I think, had 47 demonstrations against the wall. Popular committees have been springing up, and now, of course, the leaders of the popular committees are being arrested, and because there aren't any good charges to lay against people who are just involved in nonviolent resistance to something, they're being charged with secret evidence that only the judge can see. They're being administratively detained, i.e. held in jail for months at a time. Even the Israeli Supreme Court has ruled that they shouldn't be administratively detained for just being active against the wall, and yet then the Israeli military court will come back and say, yes, but we're going to put them in administrative detention anyway. I think you saw there's some people who are camping on their land, even though they've been separated from it. People have held very powerful demonstrations, even prayer sessions in olive groves. There's the Stop the Wall campaign in Palestine. You mentioned that, and you all can talk more about that. There's a day and a week against the wall. We're in that. I'll just mention some of the other things that have happened around the world. And a lot of these are campaigns focusing on ending the occupation, but the wall has become a major part of that work. The European Social Forum has included calls for a free Palestine. In South Africa, they demonstrated against a visit by Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. He would be another good international criminal court candidate. Norway demonstrators in Oslo have been supporting Palestinian freedom. In Germany, they've been doing the same thing. There have been, I like this one. This is just from around the world. I'm not listing everyone. But one of my favorites is that the Irish Palestine Solidarity Committee has called on Irish folks to boycott Israeli potatoes to end apartheid. In Beirut, there's a call for a sit-in outside a UN building in Beirut until the wall falls. Those people may be sitting there for a long time. There was a 48-hour fast called on the Santa Monica Pier in Palestine. There are many different anti-wall groups springing up in the United States and in Canada. All you have to do is go on the web and find those. There's an anti-wall task force which is trying to coordinate activities against the wall formed by grassroots Canadian and American groups. So that may be a cross-border task force to hook into. Their headquarters is at the National Council for Arab Americans, I think in D.C., I'm not sure. In Seattle, we have a group who's working on Stop the Wall specifically. They have built sections of the wall at full height with big PVC pipe and then gray like canvas or tarp. They have also built it at half height just to show people what it will look like. They have built a small wall and put it on a trailer, and they're taking it on tour around the country. At RPSC in Seattle, we built a mobile walking wall with PVC pipe and Corex and a little guard tower with a person in it. Humor is a good thing to sort of lighten up this terrible situation, but also try to bring people to know more about the situation who might not do it if you just kind of lecture at them. So we put slogans on our walking wall, things like coming soon through a living room near you, and walk around our demonstrations with that. So those are just some ideas to get you started, and I know Erica and Derek are going to talk more about a specifically Canadian approach to the wall. Please let your fellow activists south of the border know how we can support you in whatever you're doing, and I hope that you will consider us favorably for sanctuary should we need it. Thank you.